Okay, we are live. Hello, welcome everyone to Cannabis Marketing Live. I am Jake Litke, the CEO of MediaGel. I am your host today, and we have returning, which may be our most frequent guest now.
Three-timer.
We'll start to do it like SNL, where you get the jacket, you know?
That's right.
But we're here, and we have Matt again, because we're going to be talking more about data. We have, you know, topics that we cover, but it is a complex subject, so we're doing more of these to get into more details. So today we're going to be talking about navigating third-party data, how to use it, how not to use it, what the different categories are. For those of you that have not joined us before, Matt, maybe you could just do a quick bio about yourself and why you have some context to give here about third-party data.
Sure. Yeah. Matt Taverna, principal at Statera Solutions. We are a data company and data solutions company. We build a national consumer file of 260 million Americans, or over 260 million Americans, that compiles every American adult. And we do analytics based on certain demographics that we've attached to that file, and we make it available for data matching and audience creation and marketing. Integrations with a few different cannabis tech companies. But first and foremost, our relationship with MediaGel, where our data is activated for display and CTV and other digital ads.
Great. Thank you for that. Okay. So let's dive into it right away. And I think that it's always good to lay some foundational pieces of information here. And I know we've gone over this before, but really quickly, give us a definition of first versus second versus third-party data. We're going to be focusing mostly on third-party data, but that sometimes can bleed over into the other.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, first-party data is data that you as a customer owns. It's a customer loyalty list. It's a opted-in text message list. It's an opted-in email list. And the actions you take on that data are related to the agreement you have with the customer on how you're going to use their data. So like in the when they sign up, you know, they check the box for the terms and conditions, and that is the license that you then have to use that data. Usually it's just, you know, remarketing to those customers and maybe gleaning some things about that customer from what you know about that data.
And then
second party data. Okay.
Before you go into the second part, let's mention something about first party data. So Matt mentioned that there's supposed to be some sort of agreement that is in place. So the most simple version that most people would see is if you're doing remarketing off of your website visitors. And in order to really be doing that in a compliant way, you need to have a privacy policy on your website. And of course, you know, there's a cookie notification. So then there's more complex things on first party data, like maybe you have email addresses or you've got phone numbers or any of those things. Now, if you didn't actually enter into some sort of agreement, it doesn't have to be complicated, but you really do need to have record or at least have someone check a box or agree to receive communication from you in the future. So that's an important distinction. Just because like someone hands you a list of email addresses does not necessarily mean that you have the legal right to just send them messages. So that's an important thing to talk about first party, and we'll get into how that affects other things.
Yeah. Second party data is data then that you will either append to your first party data to know more about that first party data record. So if you have Matt Taverna as a customer, who's opted into a first party communication, like we just talked about, the second party data would be then data that you would buy, or that you would record, or that you would create yourself, that describes Matt Taverna. It would be, you know, 42-year-old male. You might append some demographics. You might append, some new address information, from the, like, you know, National Change of Address Service for the U.S. Postal Service. You might, be able to attach some of my purchase habits from your point of sale to that customer record. And then, so that creates like a second party data element that you've attached to your first party data. And you know, that is, you know, I would say that second party data trends in for this conversation more toward the first party data conversation, because it's a little bit like the human brain, the human body. Like the second party data is not worth very much without the first party data attached to it, and then and vice versa. And so third party data is kind of the what we're talking about today, and where the I think the compliance and privacy issues are most prevalent in the discussions today. It is data that you do not own, that and it's data that, that you purchase from a literally a third party. So this could be in the form of digital audiences that, you know, when you go to serve digital ads, you serve to audiences that you don't necessarily have a relationship with, other than the fact that you think they're a prospective customer. It could be in the form of in certain industries, a purchased mailing list that you mail your direct mailer to. And another, in certain industries, it could be a phone list, you know, a list of phone numbers that you then call through to reach folks. That is, and then kind of from order, like the in reverse order is probably the most regulation on phones than to mail than to digital, as far as you know, what you can do with third party data. And, yeah. And then, okay.
And so we can delineate a couple of there's utilizing the data, and then of course, as you're saying, there's how you're using the data, right? So, for example, the sort of lowest threshold is something where you would buy, let's say, a third party audience for doing digital targeting for a digital audience via display advertising. So there's thousands of these audiences. They could be dog owners or Democratic voters. There's a lot of different things that you purchase from a third party. And frequently in that interaction, you never take custody of the actual identity of the audience itself. You're going to go into your buying platform and say, I want to use this audience. And then the advertising exchange kind of does the work around targeting those audiences, and you never take custody of them. So there's much less compliance required there. And you're also not, when you're doing display advertising, you're not reaching out proactively to someone directly. All you're doing is saying that, you know, of the impressions that are available, I want my impression to show up to this particular person. So that whole...
And for those of you, like for anybody who doesn't understand what like taking custody means, it literally means like you won't be accessing a spreadsheet of columns of first name, last name, address, city, state, zip, phone number, gender, race, age. You like for digital audiences in the way that they're traditionally created, the end client, the advertiser, does not actually ever have that spreadsheet. So
correct. So you have much less compliance risk there, because you don't actually know who the people are. You're just targeting them as a group, right? And so and this is something that's commonly done. You would kind of see a similar thing if you've ever advertised in Facebook or Google. They've got drop downs. You don't get to know who those people are. You just know that they may match some sort of feature that you want in your advertising campaign. So that's talking about display advertising. Now, the other channels where third-party data is utilized, it can be utilized for direct outreach, right? And so you've got email, you've got phone calls, and you've got text messages. And each one of those channels has its own set of best practices, but it also has its own set of laws. The things that you're allowed to do via email versus text versus calling are all very different. And in some cases, it's different in different legislations, legislative areas, right? So like California specifically has CPAA, which is a more stringent set of laws. And I do think, you know, there's other states that are adopting similar ones. And you've got the CAN-SPAM Act, you've got CANOA, and then you also have what's the minors one? Why can't I think of it right now?
There are state level regulations that kind of regulate the, you know, the age of the universe that you're targeting, and then this applies to cannabis and alcohol and tobacco sports wagering?
At different levels, right? Because there's actually just laws in general about advertising to anyone that's like under 13, for example.
Oh, right. Okay.
But then there's specific laws around what you can do when it comes to controlled substance or regulated products. And then there's category specific rules, right? So if you're doing anything with housing, for example, you can't do targeting based on income or ethnicity because of the Fair Housing Act. So there's a lot of different ways that you can run into this, but let's try to focus mostly on cannabis because that was the topic here.
Let's go through what you were talking about. Email versus, like third party email. Legal perspective, again, none of this is meant to be legal advice. We can kind of advise on our experience, but from a legal perspective, I would never use a third party email list ever. And if you are planning on going to a data provider to ask them for emails of people you don't know, I would advise strongly against that for the legal reasons, but also it is a horrible best practice. And it is a horrible ROI. If you have like 100,000 people, then you get the email address for those 100,000. You're going to get a delivery rate of somewhere between, 25 and 40%. So you're down to 35,000 emails. And then the click-through rate is going to be somewhere like around 3% of that. So it just dwindles your actual target audience down, whoever's going to receive the message. And then the return on 100,000 emails that from a third party is like usually will get less than one conversion.
Negative conversions, which right, people exactly. will call yeah, and people. Email you yeah. and yeah. be mad. In addition to those people being upset with you and your brand, there is a thriving ecosystem of lawyers and law firms that litigate against this type of behavior, right?
And ads to companies that will start to ban your URL from email platforms, but also other parts of ad tech. Yeah.
Yeah. You will see, like I said, there's an active community of lawyers out there that will start writing letters. They'll write legal letters. We received this email. We're not on your list. Why did you send it? And if you don't have some way of proving that that person did opt in, then you can find yourself in some trouble.
Yeah. So third party emails, that's a definite no-no. Third party phone numbers. This is something I worked in politics for a long time before I got into cannabis and the other retail work I'm doing. And phone calls were and remain a really big in third party phone calls, phone numbers remain a really big part of the political data industry. And that is because out of all the robo dialing and other laws associated with phone numbers, politicians made it their goal to exclude themselves from those laws. So for politics, third party email phone numbers work well. There's a couple studies out there that say that they are that they can have that kind of negative conversion Jake talked about, specifically around somebody's willingness to give money or to make a commitment to the a political campaign, to volunteer or something like that. But the research also shows that that could be overshadowed by the fact that the voter turnout is largely enhanced by contact from unsolicited phone calls and texts. So, but yeah, other industries, yeah, good.
I don't know how many dispensaries or brands are, calling customers up and telling them they have.
Robocalls. But I think we can put SMS in the same category. You can't just get a. Outside of politics, it is inadvisable, at least, and illegal at the worst and against the law to actually be buying third party cell phone lists and sending unsolicited text messages. So it's a bad legal practice. It's a bad business practice. And it's why also you should be keeping up to date your current SMS lists, because if you start to text many of the wrong people, if you have a list that's like 2 or 3 years old and those numbers have kind of gone stale, you could be getting in trouble because you're now using it, what would be like a third party phone number on a person that you thought you knew, but now you do not, because that phone number belongs to someone else.
Yeah, there's also thresholds that occur when you're sending in many platforms anyway. You generally need to keep your, when you were sending texts out, under a certain threshold of unsubscribes. If you grabbed a list of phone numbers that you didn't have necessarily ownership of, and you sent out a bunch of messages, and that resulted in a large number of people unsubscribing, that'll create problems with your texting platform usually also, because they have their own quality levels that they need to maintain in order to keep their connections live with the carriers. There's a whole separate conversation to be had about like 10DLC and short codes and what you can and can't do with text. And I know there's a lot of struggles with that in the cannabis space, and that continues to get worse, but we're not going to dive into that now. Maybe we'll do that in a future conversation. Let's circle back to third-party audiences. Now we're not talking about just like phone numbers or emails. We've kind of covered that buying those from people is not a good practice necessarily. But let's talk about the ways that third-party data is used and how people see success with it.
Yeah, so I think the first way is traditional direct mail. And then the third-party direct mail is legal. It's federally legal. It is legal in every state. There are certain regulations around direct mail. Like, you can't be mailing people misinformation and disinformation. You can't be, sending them pyramid schemes or financial schemes and things like that. But that's more related to fraud and crime than the mail itself. Direct mail is still a tried and true retail practice. And actually, because it's based on something that the United States government has a 250-year history of investment in residential addresses and in the postal service, it is a very accurate way of reaching the person you want to reach, if they will read the mail. So all that being said, using the third-party data for mail is tried and true. It's a good use of your dollars if you kind of know what you're doing. And then the last is creation of digital audiences. And this is kind of where there's kind of two ways that this is done, at least from the work that Statera and what we do with MediaGel and other digital advertising agencies is there's third-party data that lives in digital marketplaces, digital data marketplaces. And then, Jake, do you want to talk about a little bit of that, of like, sure, how those audiences are created and displayed?
Yeah. So there's a few different broad categories that we use. I mean, we use audiences every day for our advertisers, and we're serving millions of impressions. And so there's a lot of different tactics depending on what you're doing. So the larger categories, the more obvious categories, I would say, are we do a fair amount of geospatial retargeting. So we have the ability to draw polygons or circles based on locations where mobile devices have been seen in the past. The on-the-nose version of this is we have every dispensary in the country geoframed, right? And so we can build an audience of these are devices that have been seen in a dispensary, and then we can target them with ads when we're actually running the ads. So here's an example of no one having custody of this information, right? The data itself is aggregated from thousands of applications where users have opted in to share their location information in an anonymous fashion. When we set up the campaign, we say, hey, these are dispensary visitors, or it could be yoga studio visitors, or whatever it is that you want to come up with, specific retail locations. That's one example. So there's geo-retargeting, is what we'll say that, rather than, a lot of people talk about geofencing. Just for clarification, usually geofencing refers to where the ad is being served at the time of impression. So I want to serve ads in a 10-mile radius around my retail location. That's a geofence versus like a geo, like a historical geo audience is where someone has seen in the past. that's one category. Another common one is purchasers, right? So you have, there is data available from companies such as New Frontier, among others, where they have, again, anonymized audiences of, these are people that have purchased vapes or CBD products or edibles by category. And then if you're running a campaign, let's say you're launching a new edible line, you can then serve impressions to people that have, that you know, have purchased those products in the past. The other large category, and this is, we do a lot of this work with Statera, is the, some of the demographic stuff that we talked about earlier, where it's, I want to target people of a specific income range or that have specific interests. And maybe Matt, you could talk a little bit about, actually, before I hand that off to you, I'll say that one of the downsides to anonymous third-party audiences is that frequently you have no idea where that data came from, right? So you can go into any demand media platform that exists and buy ads, and you can pick an audience that says these are dog lovers, but generally there's nothing underneath that to understand where they got that data from. If you're working with some specific companies, it's good to understand where the data came from and how they came up with those numbers, because you can, there's a fair amount of freedom that people have to be able to say, oh, this is a dog lover, but they don't tell you how they did it. So one of the reasons we partnered with Statera is they have all this demographic information, and maybe you can talk about how that data gets
collected. Yeah, I mean, so they, and I think what Jake is making the distinction between what is called probabilistic data, which is based on probabilities of someone to be a dog lover, dog owner, versus deterministic data, which is kind of a known piece of information about someone. So in the case of, a known cannabis purchaser list that, like New Frontier and others kind of produce those data sets, that piece of known data is a deterministic data point, even if it's a third party list. So even if you don't know this person, you at least know they bought cannabis, you're going to advertise them compliantly. On your first party data, that's absolutely a deterministic data point. You can even have a SKU number attached to that, right? But for the majority of digital market audiences on data marketplaces and DSPs and such, most of that data is based on probabilistic data or modeled data. And so that is compiled with certain behaviors or certain indicators that a ad tech company would know about someone. So and this information comes from things like surveys. If you fill out a warranty card, a lot of that data is sold on open marketplaces from data brokers. If you use your CVS card, or I don't want to indict CVS, but those kind of loyalty programs, that data is sold, and not in a nefarious way, in ways that just kind of enhance consumer brands. Those data points, like if I shop someplace at a frequent basis, then the model data is that I have a propensity to shop at that place, but it may not be based on my known, visits, right? All that model data kind of gets put into audiences that are then available to be targeted against online. What Statera does is a little bit different in that we base our targeting on, like I said, we build a 260 million person database. We base our audience building on known elements about people that we have on that big database. So we have we ingest a lot of purchaser data. We do really robust surveys that we're always in field, creating those data elements. And then we also just we do a really heavy scraping and acquisition of government data sets that kind of tell all sorts of demographic information on individuals that can be used in certain use cases for compliance and targeting of those individuals. And then we can, so like I said in the beginning of the call, like there's a spreadsheet at some point. We, Cetera, act as a third party processor, but we actually have that spreadsheet of the targets that we can set, that we then send over with certain identifiers and IDs that can sync up to software like MediaGel and with AdTech that can be served to that deterministic audience. And we sit on an identity graph that actually is able to make that sync from our offline data set to the online data set in a way that kind of cuts through some of the black box around other audience building.
Yeah, so let's walk through a scenario where you go, because your data sets can translate into the different categories, right? Right. So I'll give you an example of a sort of a full chain here, which is that one of the things that we can do now is you could take your CRM data, your customer data. Let's say you've got a list of 10,000 emails that are your customers of your dispensary or retail location or whatever it is. You can onboard that into a platform and it can take the email addresses and they can hash them into something that is now encrypted and anonymized. That hashed value can then go into, and that's your first party data at this point, but now we're going to go send it into a third party. In this case, we're going to send it to Statera, right? Take those email, those hashed email addresses, those then turn into an addressable audience that you can retarget ads to on phones, on cell phones while people are, you know, reading the news or playing games on their phone. So that's one example of a sort of a round trip there. And in that case, you as the advertiser or customer owner, you've never taken possession of that information. That happened in a clean room and inside of the Statera data warehouse. That they send a then anonymized audience to your advertising provider, in this case us, although it could be someone else, and then we're able to serve ads to them. So that's one use case. Another use case is taking that same original CRM data, putting it into the identity graph, and then getting a lookalike audience. And so what happens in that transaction is because those identities can be measured across all the demographic scoring. So again, we mentioned age, gender, there's like 500 of these things. But what you can do is say, these are people in my market that are buying my products. I want you to return me a list of other people in that same market that are not my current customers, but also have, let's say, like a 95% scoring rate in terms of the characteristics of the people that are purchasing things.
Yeah, which is like in the dumbest version possible of saying this is that, like, if you have a certain SKU that you want to try to sell more of, you can look at that SKU and you can see your customer list of the 30,000 people that have bought that SKU in the past 6 months. And you can say, oh, wow, how are all these people? What are all these people have in common? And I'm looking at Jake and I, and let's just run the cliche. These are all 40-year-old men. Wow. Most of these people that buy this SKU are 40-year-old men. And those are your known customers. So then what you would do is take that list and through kind of much more sophisticated analysis than I just gave, the ad tech company that's running your ad could then not only target your current customer list, that includes, like, again, that 40-year-old man who's buying all those pre-rolls or whatever, it could then find all of the 40-year-old men who are living near your dispensary, or that, you know, live near a retailer that has your brand on their shelves. And so, like, a lookalike model is just, like, you know, looking like your customer. But that's the using first party data to create what is a third party data element. That lookalike model is utilizing the third party category to kind of, like, expand your prospective customer base.
Yeah, great. Thank you for that. I do want to mention here for those of you in Zoom, I don't think we can see the ones on LinkedIn or YouTube, but if you're in Zoom, there is a Q&A section. If you have any questions that you'd like Matt or I to answer, feel free to type those in. And we'll get to those here in a few minutes. All right. So let's see, what's our next topic here?
We touched on this a little bit, but if you want to shift to, you know, like the compliance around cannabis specifically and how data plays heavily into that. I think taking our example of you've now noticed that you want to target a certain group of people to be prospective customers because they look like your current customers. You want to make sure that when you're targeting the new group of customers, that you need to be complying with your state's regulations around advertising in cannabis, which kind of first and foremost for what we're going to be talking about with demographics and third-party data is really about age, number one. But it also concerns geography in some ways, just because of the way that there's no advertising in school zones. A lot of the state regulations are not prescriptive on what that truly means. So I'll dive into ways that we've solved that in the past and what can be done. That sound good?
Yeah, go for it.
Next, so we have like I said, we compile age data from government sources, from testing that we do, from different third-party brokers that we work with, to then make sure that we are only cutting lists that contain individuals who are over the age of 21 and who can be compliantly advertised to for cannabis. And then because of the identifiers that we have, we make sure to have like a one-to-one link from our identifier to the digital identifier. And so then the intent is there that we are only advertising to people who are 21 plus. This is important because when you go back to what Jake was talking about with digital audience creation and the fact that there's a black box that surrounds that audience creation, there's really no way for if a digital audience has the age of 21, there's no great way to know in a deterministic way how that audience was assigned that age. So there's algorithms that assign age. There are, again, indicators that assign age, but there's no deterministic data element like a government source or a tested source or a survey source that goes back to, why that person was assigned that age. At least there's not one that you can see. And not one that you will have ready access to if and when a state regulator asks you about your advertising. So like that, I mean, that's a data practice that I shamelessly being salesy here, we built our entire cannabis data practice on. It's one that's kind of near and dear to my heart as a policy matter. Like I worked on kind of data policy and age data policy for a while with in tobacco control. So, were you going to say something before? I didn't.
Yeah, I was going to say that a lot of people aren't probably aware of, unless you are deep in the weeds in the advertising industry, in the history of the advertising industry, a lot of the ways that advertisers would say that, you know, it's because there's something called LDA, which is widely used, which is legal drinking age. This predates cannabis being legal at all, used a lot by the alcohol industry and other categories that are not supposed to be targeted towards children. Largely that effort was being born by the publishers, meaning the TV network or the website or whatever it was, and them determining that their audience was a certain makeup and it was mostly adults, right? And so some of this would be as simplistic as this is a website that has content that children generally aren't interested in, so they're not going to be here. Right. That's in some cases, as far as that went, that was the entire compliance argument that was being used. And so traditionally, when you go into a digital media buying platform, some of those things still exist. The IAB, the Advertising Bureau, has categories, right? They have a category for health and wellness, they have a category for alternative medicine, which sometimes cannabis falls into that. They have one for cigars, which encompasses all of tobacco. They've got alcohol and they have other ones. But largely what has happened is that the publishers have said, this is my audience. My audience is mostly over 21. So you are safe to advertise here, assuming that we will accept your ads. And so with the amount of legislation that exists around cannabis, relying on that as your compliance protection layer is just not good enough anymore. Especially when you have states now saying, like New York, where they want 90% of your audience to be 21 or over. That there's not very many ways that a publisher can actually verify that's true. So while there hasn't been a lot of litigation or I think fines being levied to date, mostly because I think the state boards are busy doing other things, it is a potential risk to you as an organization.
And I think, I think that it's even like a little bit more like a little bit more real than that. Just like the risk of fines and regulators come after you is sure. That's like, I guess, first and foremost as a business and legal practice. But I think there's something a little bit more like existential about it, is that we've seen, and if you think about like the 100-year history here of consumer products in the United States, there's a debate over whether cannabis should be inviting federal legislation and regulation. Do we want that? Do we not want it? Do we want it in certain areas and not? Once we're inviting federal oversight, once the market does kind of mature, the scrutiny against products and how they're advertised is going to be greater and greater and greater. So like I said, if you look at the 100-year history of consumer products, it is based in, alcohol, tobacco, vapes, all had their moments of really doom for those industries at certain times. The regulation around alcohol is largely self-regulated, and these strict laws in the middle of the century, from like the end of Prohibition to probably, the late 80s, early 90s, that alcohol wasn't advertised on TV. That was self-regulated because they were terrified of Prohibition coming back. And then you have these, cigarette laws, and I worked in tobacco control the first part of my career, that number one, they were reactive from the federal government and state governments. A lot of them are based on lawsuits, and essentially put the cigarette industry out of business in the United States. At least it's a shell of its former self. And in a kind of speed reading way, the same thing happened to vapes, at least, the kind of mainstream brands of vapes in the past just 5 years, where you had vape companies as a booming industry. I'm talking about nicotine vapes that have become a pariah. And pariah, even like with their own kind of customer base, for what happened. And so I don't believe that cannabis is as harmful any of the products I mentioned, but like it is to the industry's detriment, like if we don't follow those, learning experiences, because it's just like, we don't want to be dealing with reactive regulation on this stuff. We have proactive regulation from state regulators. It's a patchwork. Some states are getting it right. Some states are not getting it right. there's like limited enforcement. There's arbitrary enforcement perhaps, but proactive regulation and then proactive kind of enforcement is much, much better than reactive. And so to be relying on, I think, best practices that may be like just barely passing the legal test is to the detriment of the industry in the long term. Because there's going to be a, you know, the seminal moment in as a federally regulated industry where lots of people are going to be asking lots of questions, and it's not only going to be politicians. It's not only going to be the public health community. It's going to be our own customers. It's going to be the families of our customers kind of like wondering what's next. And that's not a position we want to be in. I know I got very high and mighty and like very soapboxy there, but it's like, this is all to say like there's a easy and cost effective and you know, compliant way to get this all done. And yeah, it's using those deterministic data elements on age. So you have that paper trail. So you have the trust of your data source. And most importantly, so you have the actual like beginning of a relationship with a potential customer that's based in like a fact rather than an assumption.
Yeah. And you do see different things in different states, right? So we're running campaigns in every legal state right now. And we run into, you know, states are all doing things differently, and there's different layers of compliance that we have to deal with. You know, aside from the third-party data, we have to deal with compliance around the creatives themselves. Some states require a license, others don't. Some states require creatives to be approved by a state board, others do not. Florida is actually pretty pretty proactive, I would say, in terms of what they're doing. Not only do they have some, are they pretty stringent on the creatives, but they also require at this point, at least if you're in compliance and doing what the state wants you to do, you actually have to explain as an advertiser how you are targeting people so that they are over 21. Mm. And that is, you know, we've gone in a couple cycles with that, right? Okay, here's what we're doing. We're proactive and asked, okay, what is the methodology behind that? How do you actually know that this is over, someone who's over 21 or at least to the compliance level? So it's all over the place. And I'll give you an example coming back to text messaging, where there was an entire category of product that just doesn't exist anymore. And that is that in the mid 2000s, you used to be able to subscribe to things via text message, right? And it would show up on your carrier bill.
The entire Twitter app was through texting.
No, but I mean, you're on Verizon, right? Yeah. And you want to subscribe to some product, you'd have a short code text, you know, subscribe to 88888 or whatever it was. Crazy Frog. Yeah. That. So what was happening, though, is that there were marketers selling largely content at the time, ringtones and wallpapers, and they were selling subscriptions. And they were targeting those subscriptions to children. And those children were signing up on their parents' cell phone bill. And that was creating a $10 a month subscription that was by and large going unnoticed.
Because you weren't just opting into the subscription, you're opting into a bill as well.
A bill, it was a monthly bill. You're $9.99 and they're $5.99 or whatever it was.
Yeah, it was a paid subscription, okay.
Yeah, so you get ringtones or wallpapers, whatever it was, games.
Emojis, remember those? The interactive emojis on a Samsung phone?
It would just show up on a line item, right? You'd have like, here's your unlimited calling, here's your text messaging plan, here's blah, 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 blah. It just kind of was in there, right? And there was, I think, six states' attorneys general that banded together and sued all the companies that were doing this, right? And they sued, I forget the names of the companies that were doing it, but they all got sued completely out of existence. And then there was, you know, follow on and indemnification things that was going on. There's a kind of a long court case, but the eventual thing that happened is nobody subscribes to things on their cell phone bills anymore. They're just like, that's done. No more. Right. Because it was abused so much. So there's a lot, there's 51 states or 50 states. It only takes one or a handful of states AGs to decide they want to go after something. And it can make everyone's life a lot more difficult if we're not proactive as it, as an industry.
Yeah. I mean, and so we've actually put a, like a couple other best practices in place. I said earlier on the call that there's rules around advertising in school zones, but the state regs don't really make it clear whether that means you can't mail into a school zone, you can't put a digital ad into a school zone, even if it's a residential home. So we've partnered with Niche, which they make the school, they do like school rankings and school reviews and things like that. We partnered with them to get use their location data on schools to exclude homes that abut schools, like the property, and also within 1,000 feet of a school. And so, and that's something that I think that it is, like I said, it's not prescribed in the state regulation, but the more that we as an industry, and I mean this, like more we as an industry do these things to kind of lead the way in compliance, we can be at the table then when the feds come a knocking, because we will have set the tone for like what regulation should look like, and be hand in hand with state regulators rather than kind of being chopped up at the table, and having, you know, our advertising rights and our rights for free speech kind of limited because of like actions that people say that we were bad actors or something like that. That's not a position we want to be in. And like, so data governance, data compliance is like a huge part of that. It's largely because we'll have the receipts, you know, we'll have the receipts on what we've done.
Yeah. If you, you know, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the advertising regulations, as we call them, that are put in place by they're really put in place by the advertising industry, right? As a proactive way of saying, look, we understand the risks and what we should and shouldn't be doing, and we're enforcing that as an industry, so that the federal or state governments don't need to come in and start creating laws, right? Because they're not domain experts, and they're largely gonna, like what happened in California, right? So there was a bill passed in California that its intention was to protect minors from advertising that was deemed to be targeted at children. Some of this is coming from brands, you know, like cookies and such. But the net effect of it was the way that it was written basically banned any cannabis company from putting any photos or illustrations in any ads at all, right? Which is overreach. And that's what happens when you have people that aren't domain experts in a particular business category trying to write laws around it. So we're just about up on time here. So I don't know if we had, let me just see if there's any other topics we wanted to cover. We've kind of ran the gamut here. I guess we can, on that note, which is, you know, let's all be good citizens, pay attention to what we're doing, and try to be proactive about using data in a compliant way, and using data, not just third party data, but for targeting, but using it to make sure that we are, you know, interacting with adults and the people that we should be in the cannabis industry.
Yeah. And to that end, this is, I try to like end with a sweaty salesman pitch. Statera is offering, between now and MJ Biz, a free data quality assessment, which is we will look at your first party data and we will tell you the number of addresses we could update that are out of date, the number of phone numbers we could update on your first party data that are out of date. We can help you with formatting of your lists. We can help you to merge lists from multiple CRMs and dedupe those. So sales@statera.com. Reach out. We'll give you a data quality assessment and help you with these best practices.
Can you do a data quality assessment on just all the things that are in my cell phone, like my personal address book? Because I think some things are out of date on that.
Probably.
Probably. All right. Probably. But in all seriousness, so you can reach out to sales@statera.com if you want to hear more information about Matt or get a hold of him on LinkedIn. Myself as well, I can be reached on LinkedIn, Jake Litke. MediaGel, if you want to do compliant digital advertising for cannabis brands, reach out and we can take a look at it. So appreciate everyone's time today. This has been Cannabis Marketing Live. Matt Taverna of Sotera and Jake Litke. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.